Welcome back to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. This week, we'll bring you two different perspectives on the Chesapeake Bay. Dave Namazi is the Associate Vice President for External Affairs at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, and has been closely following the health of the bay from both a scientific and a policy point of view for years. He joins us to take a crack at the big questions facing the bay, from what we can do to prevent runoff from polluting the water to how we're going to ensure the economic health of the communities who depend on the bay. Then we take a look at some of the smallest inhabitants in the bay with Dr. Jamie Pearson. He's an assistant research professor at the University of Maryland's Horn Point Lab, and his work focuses on plankton, some of the smallest, but perhaps the most important inhabitants of the bay. First, here's Dave Namazi. I started by asking him for his perspective on the overall state of the Chesapeake Bay.
The Chesapeake Bay has been really improving in some areas, particularly in the upper portion of the Chesapeake, where we've had very large submerged aquatic vegetation beds grow back. There are several other systems. The Nanticoke River system is still has maintained a fairly healthy river system. The areas where we're actually particularly going down are areas that have been highly impacted by non-point source pollution. And two areas to kind of compare and contrast. One would be the Chop Tank River, which has a lot of non-point source pollution, particularly from agriculture. Another area would be the systems around Annapolis area or Anne Arundel County area, which are heavily developed areas, which have also been continuing to decrease in health. The South, the Severn, there's several other rivers. And those rivers have been going down largely due to stormwater systems and the amount of impervious surface in those watersheds is very high. And the amount of runoff coming off of those impervious surfaces to stormwater systems that are not very good to begin with, with septic systems that are not very good to begin with, have all led to a continued degradation of those systems.
So the report card that comes out on the bay,
right.
I mean, it's not failing, but it's not in good shape.
Right. I mean, that's right. The last, and we shouldn't be satisfied with a C grade, which, you know, the report card has been showing is, you know, mediocre. The bay is mediocre in a lot of its indices, and we shouldn't be satisfied with that. The reality is there are differences in the areas of the Chesapeake Bay, and we need to really have a good understanding of where the bay is doing really well and where it's getting worse. One, to make sure that policymakers and the citizens understand the areas that are getting worse so they could try to affect change. Two, for the areas that are getting better, we have to have a better understanding of why they're getting better and be able to apply those lessons learned to the whole Chesapeake system.
So give me a sense of where they're getting better and what you mean by that.
This area in the upper Chesapeake Bay, the Bush River system and the Susquehanna Flats area has been getting better over several years. The main thought behind that is that there's still a very large viable marsh system up in that area. There's also been several there's still the watersheds there are still fairly protected. There hasn't been a lot of development in that one region, although it's a high growth area though, so we have to keep our eye on it. The other main change we think is the fact that there is a very, very large submerged aquatic vegetation grass bed there. That these grass beds are great at taking sediment out of the water, taking up nutrients. And they actually sort of do a self-cleansing where the larger the seagrass bed, the better it is for more seagrass. And so it's a positive feedback system that that allows, once you get a seagrass bed large enough, it really helps protect that water quality. And so the water quality has only been getting better and better and better. So it's in a positive trajectory right now. And we think that's somewhat due to positive feedback loops. So we have to really get a better understanding of those positive feedback loops. What develop what has taken place on the land, what changes have been taking place on the land that's had a significant impact. It's a really simple question to ask. It's a hard question to answer because a lot of pollutants take a long time for moving from the land into the water. The groundwater pathways tend to be fairly slow. So it's not like you take an action today and you see a result tomorrow. That is the case with upgrades and wastewater treatment plant. You have an end of a pipe where you do it, you change something today and it starts getting better fairly rapidly. When you make changes on non-point source pollution, those changes tend to be, one, very gradual. You have to work with numbers of people to make effective change. Two, the actual pathway of that water going from that pollutant source, let's say a septic system, to the bay itself is a very slow and long pathway.
So let's take some of these things and and walk through them in terms of what, starting with the factors that are affecting the bay, the health of the bay, then let's kind of move it on. There are a number of factors that are pointed out from here in the report card that came out, pollutants being factor one.
Right. So nitrogen and phosphorus is our – nitrogen and phosphorus is the, are the main two pollutants that we're most concerned about in Chesapeake Bay. Basically, they're fertilizers. And as one puts fertilizer on a lawn, which hopefully everyone will put less and less on, when you apply them either on agriculture or on lawns, they eventually can move if you over-fertilize in particular – it can move into the Chesapeake Bay. Human waste has a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus in it. The exhaust of our cars has some nitrogen in it. Power plants release nitrogen. So all these factors, all these things that we do every day, has we're leaking nitrogen and phosphorus in the way we live. And it's a matter of minimizing that leak and stopping that leak where we can to the best of our ability.
And that has to do with another factor, which is land use and what we do with the land that we have.
Right. Land use is really important. One, we want to make sure that our land has the buffering. Well, first of all, we don't want to put too many things on our land that stops the resiliency of the land to protect the water. Number two, if you've failed on number one, what you need to do is set up a system that tries to reduce the ultimately the amount of that of nitrogen or phosphorus that moves from the land into the water. One of the main ways to do it is through riparian buffers.
Which means what? What is that?
Riparian means along a river system or along a waterway. And what you want to do is put put something that could block that nitrogen and phosphorus from going from the land into the water. If you use trees, it helps, one, both at the surface level, but also through their root system. They have deep roots. They could actually take and extract nitrogen and phosphorus from the groundwater. Grass buffers are also very effective. It, as long as you're not fertilizing your area right along the waterway, grass is very effective of taking taking sediment out of the potential runoff, but also picking up nitrogen and some phosphorus as well.
As long as we're not keeping it green with too many chemicals.
Right. We have to. We really. I mean, and scientists can debate what's most important. Is it the first 10 feet, 30 feet, 100 feet? And one thing I've heard a lot of scientists say is the more the better. The more of a riparian buffer, the better. So 10 feet is great if that's all you're going to put in. 30 feet is even better because it gives that water filtering capacity that much more. 100 feet's even better. But it's diminishing return. The wider it is, the less
So who has to do this? I mean, we're looking here, sitting watching this bay, clearly that the University of Maryland Center we're in now owns this land.
That's right. We have a grass buffer, but not a tree buffer.
You have a grass buffer, not a tree buffer.
Right.
It'd be better if you had a tree buffer.
It would be. That's absolutely right.
Right.
So it would be, and we all need to do a variety.
And you guys are the ones who are telling us what we need to do out here, or are suggesting what should happen.
Right.
So the question is then, the shoreline on either side, is owned by any number of different groups of people: private landowners, farmers, institutions like this, resorts, marinas. So there's a whole varied set of people.
That's right.
That you're talking about here that's that right. would be affected by this.
Right, right. And everyone needs to do their part. But having grass buffers, tree buffers that you're not fertilizing, which we're not, is a great start. It's a matter of people enjoying the water to the capacity that they can. So obviously a marine is not really compatible with grass buffers necessarily or tree buffers because they need access to boats and so forth. Other areas you might want to set aside, if you have enough land, set aside different areas for different uses and make sure that you try to maintain trees on your property. Trees are great. You try to maintain grass buffers in other areas, and you just always try to keep something in between a pollutant source and the water to try to mitigate the movement from the source to the water as much as possible.
It's hard sometimes to get to the place we should.
Yeah, it is. It's very difficult. And it's going to take work by everyone.
So the report that came out that you're part of, the Chesapeake Bay programs, the Watershed Partners mm-hmm. report about the state of the bay. Mm-hmm. One of the things you all talk about in there is what has to happen. There's a whole section on restoration mm-hmm. and protection mm-hmm. efforts. And reducing pollution, you're suggesting that the partners in this group, which everything from farmers mm-hmm. to industry to landowners, right. et cetera, and environmental groups, mm-hmm. that 60% of the needed efforts have been implemented to reduce nitrogen mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. phosphorus sediment, which is a 3% increase from 2008, right. which is
modest improvement. Yeah. Right.
But clearly, if long-term, that's not enough.
Right. There are a couple of things, I think, that have happened on the Bay restoration from a leadership perspective that have been really positive. One, we're looking at two-year milestones instead of 10 to 20-year milestones. We always used to pick, reduction goals and put out, a 10-year time frame to get it, which might be good because you might actually be able to achieve it. But then there'd be very little metrics of seeing whether you achieved it along the way. Mm-hmm. You might do a 5-year review on a 10-year program now, partly because of technological advances that and databases that could really help track this much more carefully. All the leaders of the Bay States and EPA have decided to look at 2-year milestones so we could really see if you're failing earlier on. I think this has had a tremendous impact on the whole process because, one, the tracking and the implementation are much more closely aligned than they ever had been in the past. This is one of the important part and aspects of the governor of Maryland's Bay Stat has been trying to track implementation in real time. Not look at it 3 years ago or 4 years ago, but last week, last month.
Right.
How has that changed? I think that sends a clear message all the way down to the field folks, and when I say field, I mean that in the most general of terms, that we all need to be moving to making progressive change today, tomorrow, and next week. Not next month, not next year, not next decade. And I think it's really kind of changed the attitude of the governments of how to really be looking at this. Because by saying you might fail in a 2-year period, a lot of that same leadership that set that 2-year milestone is still going to be in place. Mm-hmm. A lot of that same staff that were working to achieve that 2-year milestone are still going to be there. And they're going to have to be responsive as to why they're not meeting their goals. It also allows us to do adaptive management much more closely, which means if you're going down a path that you think is successful, but you don't measure it for 5, 10, 15 years, that path may have actually been not the best path or maybe a failing path. By measuring it in very short time cycles, you're actually going to be able to say, you know what, we've tried this program, and this program just isn't working. We either have to change the program, scrap the program, or develop a new program. And you could do that much more rapidly if you closely tie tracking and implementation. And ultimately, the implementation that we're looking for is an increase in bay health. And that's what the report card we've been trying to achieve with the report card is really tied together, is the bay getting better or not? And that's ultimately the question people ask. When I go to a restaurant, people don't ask me, have you guys, achieved more in pollution reduction? They simply asked me, is the bay getting better or not?
Well, let me ask a personal question.
Yeah.
If you were the Chesapeake Bay,
right,
how would you feel?
You know, probably like I do as a middle-aged as a middle-aged man. I've had better days. You know, you can
you're probably going to go downhill from there. That's not a good. That's not good.
Yeah, middle-aged. I've had better days, but I'm still fighting the good fight. You're right. It may not be that great of an analogy. Let me put it this way. So, but
let me put it this way: if the bay was a human body,
how
would we be feeling?
I think we'd be really fat. And we'd be fat, not necessarily, we'd have some bad fats with us, not some good fats. Some of the bad fats with us are the bad fats of nitrogen and phosphorus, just too much of it. We have to
cut
that. We'd
be the bad fat of living in poverty, not the.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. Versus the good fat of fish and oysters and crabs. We have some of that, and we have the potential for more of it. Certainly, some of the fish species have been coming back quite well, particularly if you look at crabs. Oysters have been a challenge, but there's a lot of historical reasons for that challenge. But if we if we reduce the bad fats, we should actually be improving the good fat. And that's what we're trying to get to.
I mean, when you
If I were to assess it, there's too many bad fats that has kind of spiraled out of control. And what we've been trying to do for the last 15, 20 years is trying to get control over that diet.
Well, and it's a very tough thing because people are all terrified about how they're going to make a living and survive. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you look at the sense of health of the watershed. I asked this question before, leading to this point, which is that when you look at the freshwater streams in our watershed, it's not a very good report, really. Where over half of the 10,452 sampling locations you took were very poor or in poor condition. And I haven't looked – so – and the remaining, they're either fair, good, or excellent.
Right.
And that portion is not all leaning towards the excellent.
Right.
So,
right.
So I mean, so those are very real issues. And that the nitrogen concentration is not good. That trend is not trending in the right direction.
That's right.
So there are some – same thing with phosphorus from rivers and sediment in rivers. I mean, so these are real – these are concrete –
That's
so
right.
When you talk about what has to be implemented to change this, what we have to begin to think about as a community.
Right, right.
This is like a doctor giving us a tough lecture on where we have to go and what we have to do to make ourselves better.
Right, right. Kind of as an aside, but I'm a believer. You can put any of this in, but I'm a believer of small actions can make a big difference. If everyone takes a collective stance, you could have a big difference. And if we do some of the small things, begin doing some of the small things well, such as trying to drive less, reducing our vehicle miles per person, such as taking shorter showers, such as not fertilizing or fertilizing only when prescribed. And I would even go so far as to say, and this is for homeowners in particular, fertilizing your land under recommendations. Just try it. I suspect you'll still have a pretty green lawn. If we collectively begin taking those actions, we could start making a big difference. Then we need the big things that are beyond individual actions.
Right.
Some of the big things. We have to recognize that stormwater systems are critical to our infrastructure, number one. They are indeed expensive, and they need space to work effectively. All of those things are costly. Space is costly from a development perspective. These new systems are costly. But we have to do those to really get a handle, and therefore, the price of development is going to go up, which needs to be borne by all of society. Obviously, it's front line to the developer. But ultimately, it's the stores that go in there or the homes that go in there. They're all going to have to bear the cost. Wastewater treatment plants, that's another really big ticket item that has to be done. It has to be done very well. We have to always be pushing toward technological innovations and applying those effectively. For example, if your son, daughter, or parents or neighbor asked you what kind of computer to buy, you generally wouldn't tell them to buy a computer that was 3 years old.
Right.
So let's not be making those types of decisions when it comes to our new infrastructure. We need to be pushing the envelope on new technologies and applying those new technologies for new infrastructure for our cities, towns, and communities. I think that's really, really critical. So you need both the individual actions and you need the collective actions. And I think together, you know, we'll really start making significant progress in restoring the bay.
So just to wrap up a little bit, I'm curious about how this campus, the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Studies, plays into all that.
Right.
Because you're our macro conversation, and we had a micro conversation today.
Right.
Here on your campus.
Yeah. What we're trying to do, from a university perspective, that's we want to make a difference. Some of our research, what we're trying to do is get the best scientists in the state of Maryland working on the biggest problems faced by the state of Maryland, as well as the country, as well as the world. And then we want to be able to apply what they discover either into citizen action or into policy changes. And we want to be able to shorten the period of time between scientific discovery and impact or use, I should say, and how that new information is applied. And if that's understanding the Chesapeake Bay better, so we can tell our political leaders that impact is going to have, may not have as much of a, or that change may not have as much of an impact, or this is really where what changes you need or what policy could have the greatest impact. And we want to try to get better and better at doing that and informing our decision makers in as short of a time period as possible.
Dave Namazi, thanks for taking so much of your valuable time today on this beautiful rainy day here at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Studies.
Thank you much. Appreciate it.
That was David Namazi, Associate Vice President for External Affairs at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. We're going to take a very short break, and then when we come back, we'll talk with Dr. Jamie Pearson, who studies plankton at the University of Maryland's Horn Point Lab. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Welcome back to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Now that we've heard about the big issues that affect the Chesapeake, let's take a look at some of the smallest creatures that call the bay home. Dr. Jamie Pearson studies zooplankton at the University of Maryland's Horn Point Lab. What exactly are zooplankton? And why should we care about something so small when there are, so to speak, bigger fish to fry? You'll have to listen to find out. I'm Mark Steiner, and here we are today at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. We're about to have a conversation with Dr. Jamie Pearson here at the center. And Jamie, you're on the faculty of Maryland, right?
Yes, that's right. I'm assistant research professor here at the Horn Point Lab. Yeah.
And so this is Horn Point's a really interesting place. You do a lot of work here.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were here, I guess a month or two ago, we heard about how some folks at Horn Point were attempting to get this expedition moving to the Gulf.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And it happened.
Yes, it did. Yep, we did. We were able to. Yeah, we got funded from the National Science Foundation to go down and spend a week in the Gulf. We also had another researcher who was on another ship in the Gulf for actually a month. So the two projects are sort of linked. We're interested in how plankton and fish are responding to the dead zone down there.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got 5 years of data that was funded by NOAA up on the shelf, the Louisiana shelf in the Gulf, looking at fish and plankton populations in relation to the dead zone. But then we were able to get this rapid money from National Science Foundation to go down there and look at how that area responded to the oil spill.
So why would a senator here from the Eastern Shore, part of the Maryland system, go down to the Gulf? What was the reason, why'd you go? What's the connection, if there is one?
Well, a lot of it is just the scientific questions. There's a lot of really interesting things going on in the Gulf as far as the dead zone. With the oil spill now, that adds another layer to it. But the fact that there's this very large fishery down there, I don't know the exact numbers, but there's a huge amount of the U.S. commercial fishing, and a lot of the recreational fishing is centered in the Gulf. So there's some really interesting questions about how the ecosystem is going to respond to perturbations such as low oxygen water. And that links kind of nicely to what we're doing here in the Chesapeake, where we have seasonal low oxygen water we call hypoxia. So in the deep water of the Chesapeake, the main channel of the Chesapeake, pretty much every summer we get this region of low oxygen water. And so we can compare the two systems. There are similarities in the fact that there's low oxygen. They are both warm water systems, but there are also a lot of differences. The Gulf is a big, wide, open system. The Chesapeake is pretty closed. Both are influenced by rivers, but obviously the Mississippi is an awful lot bigger than any of the rivers that we have flowing into the Chesapeake.
So what did you find? Talk about what you discovered in the Gulf on this trip.
Well, to start off with, we were up on the shelf, so that was north and west of where the wellhead was. And we were looking at, as I mentioned, zooplankton and phytoplankton.
So it was affected by the
So we left out of Cocodrie. Some of the areas around, some of the marshes around there had seen oil. When we got down there the first week of September, we actually didn't see any oil in the water. We didn't see a sheen on the surface. We were looking for it. The preliminary data suggests that we didn't see too much signature of the oil in the water. We didn't see any at this point, but we've got a lot of water samples we're going to look at. But we're interested in the larger animals, what a lot of folks call the living marine resources, so fish, whether they're commercially or ecologically important, and then plankton, because the plankton form the basis of the food chain. So without the plankton, you don't get the fish. So that's what we were looking. We saw pretty much what we had expected. There was still a large dead zone down there. We did see a lot of low oxygen water. It was kind of spotty in some areas, so it didn't seem to cover the entire region that we were looking at. But that's also something that we see down there this time of year a lot too.
So you went down to clearly we'll get to the issues of how these are connected, but I'm curious what you ended up finding and in the Gulf that might have reminded you of the Bay.
Let's see. Well, there are the biggest difference between the Bay and the Gulf. I'm going to start with the differences because I think they're pretty striking.
Please.
So the Gulf is a big, wide shelf region. So it's fairly shallow. There's a lot of similar species between the Chesapeake and species of fish and species of zooplankton. But the Chesapeake is the deep part of the Chesapeake is a relatively narrow old riverbed from the Susquehanna River from when sea level was quite a bit lower. And the amount of hypoxia in the Chesapeake is often measured in volume, whereas in the Gulf it's often measured in area because it's this wide, flat area. In the Gulf it's often confined mostly to the bottom in a very thin layer that sticks to the bottom, whereas in the Chesapeake, in the deep channel in the middle, we see up to 50% of the water column is hypoxic. So that the level of the low oxygen water, the low oxygen water always happens down deep. If low oxygen water comes up to the surface, it gets mixed with the air. It ventilates with the air, and so you don't get the low oxygen up near the surface for very long anyway. But that's one of the big differences between the Gulf and the Chesapeake, is that we have, in terms of the depth of the water where that is low oxygen, we have a lot more percentage-wise in the Chesapeake than we do in the Gulf.
So when you found these dead zones in the Gulf, I'm curious what you were looking for. What were you looking for as you were delving into this?
Right. So we use a couple of different instruments and net tows. We're looking at plankton and fish. And we use both acoustics and nets to look at fish, so basically fish finders. And then we actually take trawl nets down sometimes to look at the fish. We also look at what's in the fish guts. So we take some of the fish out and we open the fish up and look at what is in their guts to see what they're feeding on or if they're feeding and things like that. My specialty is zooplankton. So these are tiny animal plankton that live in the sea. Now, plankton are, or any kind of organism that are moved around with ocean currents. A lot of them can swim, but they can't swim stronger than the horizontal currents in the ocean, so they get mixed around horizontally. They do swim up and down a lot, and that's kind of one of the keys, because one of the things that I'm really interested in is when you have deep water, low oxygen, is it changing where they are in the water column? So are they found higher, or are they found right at that interface? And there could be a lot of reasons they're found at that interface. Maybe they're hiding from fish that don't want to go down into the low oxygen water. Maybe there's a lot of food at that interface. So
where should they be?
Well, in general, what we see with zooplankton is they spend most of their time down deep during the day, and then they come up at night to feed, because a lot of them feed on, at least many of them feed on algae, and algae need sunlight, right? So the algae are up near the surface so that they can use the energy from the sun in order to make organic molecules, and then the zooplankton come up at night when they can feed on the algae, but when the fish can't see them or other visual predators can't feed them. So we usually see what we call a diel vertical migration, so a daily vertical migration where they're up at the surface at night and down deep. But what we do see in the Chesapeake and in the Gulf, in regions where you have a lot of bottom water hypoxia, is that migration, that movement, is actually truncated. And so they're just not moving that far.
Because they can't breathe?
Because they can't breathe down in that low oxygen water. So if it's completely anoxic, they can't breathe at all. If it's low oxygen, they might be able to tolerate it either for short periods of time, or they might be able to tolerate it more, say, than some fish that might be more sensitive.
Let's step backwards for a minute.
Sure.
Many of our listeners may know this, but many may not. Describe what the zooplankton is. Describe what a plankton is in terms of its its animalness, for want of a better term.
Right. Okay, plankton can be – so plankton comes from a Greek word, that means wanderer or drifter. Okay, so plankton are any organisms whose distribution in the world's oceans are determined by – the surface currents more than by where they want to be. So a large fish can swim. If it's in a spot it doesn't like, it can swim and it can get away. But plankton are going to be pushed around by the currents, and so that's where they're going to be distributed. So what we're talking about are the things that I'm interested in are tiny crustacean zooplankton. Zoo for animal. And the phytoplankton would be plant plankton, like tiny algae and things like that. So these are tiny crustaceans. They're related to crabs and shrimp and lobsters and things like that. They actually look like tiny shrimp. They have very complex life cycles. So because they're crustaceans, which are part of the arthropod family, like insects and things like that, they molt. So they go through different stages. As they grow, they get rid of their outer shell, and then they get bigger, and they put on a new shell.
Not that big.
Not that big, no. We're talking about the ones that we're interested in here and in the Gulf never get more than, say, a millimeter, millimeter and a half. When you get into the deep water, they might get up to 3-5, and in cold water, they might get up to like 10 millimeters. But we're talking about a millimeter long. So you can see them with the naked eye. You can see them, you know, if you hold a jar up, of seawater, you can actually see them in there. Now, they're pretty dilute. So, you know, when we do open houses here and I do a big net tow and we put them in a jar and show them to people are like, oh, I can't believe I'm swimming with them. But there's really only a couple per liter. So, you know, maybe up to 10 per quart of water out there. And these things are really tiny. So you wouldn't notice them if you were swimming.
So they form the basis of what? Who feeds on these plankton?
Okay, so the phytoplankton, which are the microscopic algae, they use the sun to grow just like plants do. So they photosynthesize. And then they're fed on by other either single-celled microzooplankton, so tiny single-celled protists and things like that, if you remember, like paramecium, things like that from your biology classes. And those in the algae and those single-celled microzooplankton are in turn fed upon by the larger macro and mesozooplankton. Those are just names that we give to different size classes. But basically, they're multicellular animals. They can be related to worms. They can be related to crustaceans like crabs and lobsters and things. Jellyfish, which are substantially bigger, are often considered gelatinous zooplankton because they're swimmers, but they're not really strong enough to swim against the horizontal currents in the ocean. Plankton is a tremendously diverse group, and it includes almost anything. Larval fish are often considered plankton because they're not real strong swimmers. So any of those things are going to be part of that very tiny part of the food chain that's going to be fed on by something that's a little bit larger, and things like forage fish. So any of the herring family, sardines, bay anchovy, which are very important here in the bay as well as down there in the Gulf. Not for commercial purposes, but they're food, they're feeder fish, basically, for a lot of the other larval, the larger fish that are commercially important.
So, so when you have low oxygen levels in the water,
yes,
what happens? What is it cause? What issues erupt from that?
Well, the main cause is that you have, for whatever reason, you'll have a very large bloom of algae on the surface. You have a lot of, and that will cause a lot of organic material to sink down deep in the bottom, and that gets decomposed by bacteria. The bacteria in that decomposition process, they're consuming the oxygen, and so the oxygen level is dropping.
And what does that affect?
It affects any of the animals that are down there. If you can imagine, you're living on the bottom, say you're a worm that can't move very fast, and suddenly you have no oxygen, or it doesn't happen that suddenly, but as your oxygen goes away, you become stressed and you can probably eventually die. So things that are living in the mud right at the bottom, we know that they can be very seriously affected and die. If you're living in the water and you can move up and down, you could conceivably get away from it, but that could cause a lot of other problems. You could be spending a lot more time in the lighted surface area where you don't want to be and where predators can find you. It could also be beneficial because you're now spending a lot more time by your food if you're say, a plankton that's feeding on algae. So if you're up near the surface, if you're forced to be up near the surface more, you're more vulnerable to predators, but you're also in contact with your food a lot more. And teasing those two things out, whether it's better for you or worse for you, is sort of one of the things we're trying to do.
So the question, I think people hear this, especially when it comes to the Bay,
yeah,
because people live here,
right,
also care about the Gulf, but we live around the Chesapeake Bay, is that to talk about, A, why we need to care about these worms or plankton. I mean, what mm-hmm. difference does it make?
Right. About plankton?
Yeah, who cares? Here we say. So?
Well, they're the food sources for almost everything that that we like that comes out of the Bay. And when we talk about plankton, we're also talking about crabs have a planktonic stage. Striped bass have their eggs and their larvae are in the plankton. We consider them planktonic. Once striped bass get a little bit bigger, they start eating the plankton as juveniles. They eat bay anchovy. Bay anchovy eat plankton. Almost their entire diet is planktonic. The larval crabs, once they get a little bit bigger and they come out of the they become eaters of plankton while they're still in the plankton. So they're eating things that are a little bit smaller for them. So we need to understand how the plankton are going if we want to understand how to better manage all of these other resources that are really important to us. Filter feeders such as oysters and clams and stuff like that, they filter plankton out of the water. So if we know the condition and the amount of plankton that's out there that are relevant to these commercially and ecologically important species, we can better understand how we need to protect them and manage them for the health of the system and for our own economies.
So when you look at the Chesapeake Bay,
yeah,
and you look at the hypoxia, the low levels of mm-hmm. oxygen in the water,
right?
And you talked about that being different than structurally than it is in the Gulf, how, mm-hmm. how it affects the Bay, and the deeper sections of the center of the Bay is where it's really affected.
Right, that's right.
Talk about what we know about what causes that. I mean, what are the root causes of this lack of oxygen in the water?
Well, there's a lot of nutrients that go into the Bay that fuel algae blooms. The algae blooms sink out and are decomposed, and that's the main things. I'm more interested in the effects and the impact. So I personally have not done a lot of research.
I mean, that's not your arena, but
not my arena. But you know, the Bay has there's an awful lot of development. There's an awful lot of agriculture. There's a lot of things that contribute to those nutrients in the Bay that are fueling the algae blooms.
We'll come back to where your expertise is, but it's interesting to me because I think that one of the things that a lot, the farmers have been saying a great deal, and that we're beginning to learn that. I think this public has to learn even more and more is that what's hurting the Bay is not just farms and agriculture, but it's also the development, what we put on our lawns. All that stuff goes into the issues that we face, you know, and we often like to kind of paint these pictures as it's bad farmer, but it's more than just farmers. Farming, it has to do with the way we live, period.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I we still have to eat. I come from a long line. I still have to eat. You know, and I come from an awful long line of farmers, and I'm just really interested in learning how the system works. And that's why I'm really interested in the plankton.
So you come from a long line of farmers?
I do. Six or seven generations up in New Jersey. So my father did not farm. But I still have some family. Well, I have an aunt and uncle who was very recently – an uncle recently retired.
But your roots are the earth and the land, the farming.
Yeah, I like to think so. Right. Spent a lot of time at the beach too, so which is kind of what brings me here. But, yeah, I think there's a buzzword in fisheries management these days. It's called ecosystem-based management. And you can't manage just, say, the striped bass population. You have to understand – the idea is that you have to understand how that population is affected by all the other things going on around it. And I think that that goes for managing the bay resources and everything else. I think that, yeah, we talk an awful lot about where the runoff comes from farms and things like that, but it's like you said, it's everything that we're doing, I think, that's contributing to what's going on with the bay, and I think it's more important to figure out how we deal with that than, you know, point fingers and things.
So let's talk about what goes on in the bay.
Sure.
So we have this low level oxygen in the bay and in the deeper center areas of the Chesapeake Bay. So talk about what that means and what's occurring there, how it's affecting the life in the bay. What's going on there when we have these low levels of oxygen?
Okay, right. So there's a couple of different ideas about how that could be affecting the bay, and to be honest, that's what we're still trying to do. And we've had three cruises this year, but it's going to take an awful long time before we get all of the
data.
Three cruises on the Chesapeake on research boats. When I say cruise, my wife always asks me to make sure I clarify. You know, this is not a Carnival cruise ship. The boats are fantastic, and we often eat very well, but. But we're working 24 hours a day on these boats. We run in shifts, and everybody's working. So what that low oxygen means, in terms of low oxygen can have two different – can have either direct effects or can have indirect effects. So directly, it can kill you. If you can't breathe, you die. So fish and plankton and things like that found in the low oxygen will suffocate. It can also have indirect effects. If it causes you to swim around a lot more, you're burning a lot more calories, and your condition factor might be – not as high as it would be if you didn't have any low oxygen. So if you have to keep moving, you might be stressed out, you might be smaller, weaker, you may not grow up to be as big. That goes for fish and it goes for plankton as well. We know that from a bunch of laboratory studies that low oxygen water, even if it's even if it happens on very short time scales, can cause reproductive failure. And what that can do is that can lessen the number of zooplankton that are out there. And if the number of zooplankton are down, then there's not as much food available for fish. So that's sort of an indirect effect to fish for hypoxia. If the organisms are hurt, then they're probably not going to be as nutritious for you. Now, the other problem with hypoxia is that it seems that jellyfish are much less affected than finfish. And so we see these huge blooms of tenophores, which are the comb jellies, and the sea nettles in the bay. And a lot of that could be contributed to because of the low oxygen water, because they're a lot more tolerant of it. So they can use more of the water column. They can go down into that low oxygen water where the fish and some of the zooplankton can't, and they can go foraging for food down there. So,
which is why some people are theorizing we have this explosion in the population of jellyfish in the Chesapeake Bay.
That's right. Yep.
And in earlier parts of the year than we expect them as well.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So do we have dead zones in the bay?
Yeah.
And what is a dead zone? Let's talk about what a dead zone is. What does
that
mean, literally?
Dead zone is just sort of a term that – I'm not sure who coined it, but it's a term for an area where there's low – so for an area where there's low oxygen that cannot support life, it's kind of a misnomer. It can support certain kinds of life. And there's another guy on campus here, another fellow researcher named Byron Crump, who's doing a lot of work with another researcher, Jeff Cornwell, and some folks from Cornell. And they're actually looking at the bacteria that are making a living in that low oxygen water. So there's tons and tons of bacteria down in that low oxygen water, which is what gets it to the low oxygen state. But they can actually live there in lower oxygen levels, and in fact, in some cases, in zero oxygen, that would kill off any of the larger animals. So a dead zone is really just any region of the water where the oxygen is too low to support, say, high, I guess, colloquially we'd call it like higher forms of life, you know, multicellular organisms and single-celled organisms that have nuclei and things like that.
And obviously then the fish that we eat.
The fish that we eat, right, yeah. All fish are a little bit more or less sensitive. You know, it's very species specific how sensitive fish are. So some fish can be more tolerant of oxygen. They need some. They absolutely need some oxygen. But some fish would be more stressed at a higher oxygen level than other fish would.
As in what? Would be more stressed and less stressed?
That's a really good question. I think animals might be I think they can be acclimatized to it. So probably the ones that live down near the bottom that periodically experience low oxygen water, even though it may not go hypoxic, it may not go real, real low, but they're going to be so some of the bottom dwellers, I think, would probably be less stressed. I'm not a fisheries guy, so I don't want to say that.
Right. You want to stay with your plankton.
So that would be my guess. We're working with some – so, you know, one of the big things about both of these projects, the Gulf and the Chesapeake one, just to get a word in about how we do science around here, is that they're collaborative. So I'm a zooplankton guy, but I'm working with some fisheries folks from the other side of the bay. We've got somebody who's a jellyfish expert working on it. We've got somebody who's an algae expert who's working on this with us. And the same thing goes for the work that we're doing in the Gulf. We're collaborating with a lot of other researchers who are experts so that we can get the full story together.
So you talked about the full story and the collaboration. So what is this collaboration? What's the full story you're looking for?
We're looking for how the entire ecosystem responds to these dead zone events, these low oxygen events. So we want to understand when we're talking about the ecosystem, we're talking about all of the animals in it and the environment that they're in. So what we want to know is how do you get from the sunlight, which fuels the algae, all the way up to the big fish? So how does that energy flow and that material flow with the growing algae all the way up to the big fish so we can understand it better? So with the Chesapeake work, we sort of map where all the low oxygen is. This is how our cruises work, is we sort of map where all the low oxygen is using some electronic instruments. And then we pick two stations, and we pick one that is sort of our normoxic control, so that doesn't have low oxygen water or certainly not as low as the other station. Then we pick a station that has hypoxia, and it's got a lot of hypoxia. And so we compare a whole suite of measurements, who's there, where they are vertically in the water column, what they're eating, who's eating who, what their reproductive success is. We compare those between the two stations in order to say this is how hypoxia affects this same system.
So I wonder if you, in terms of what you see, mm-hmm. where you put, from your perspective, the health of the bay, from where you're looking at it, the plankton man.
The plankton man. The planktoneer. The health of the bay. Well, from a plankton standpoint is you're not going to get rid of the plankton. They're going to be there. It likely will change over time depending on various pressures on the bay, whether it's hypoxia, whether it's climate change, whether it's, say, introduced species from ships coming in the bay or things like that. It's likely going to change over time. But there's always going to be some plankton out there. Now, one thing that we do see is there's probably a lot less when there are a lot of jellyfish around in the summer than there would be if there weren't jellyfish. Jellyfish are voracious eaters, and as we said, they can sort of withstand a lot lower oxygen. So if the jellyfish are being affected by the hypoxia, if there's more jellyfish because there's more hypoxia, there is likely to be less zooplankton out there, which would be the food for
and
the
maybe
fish.
Less fish.
And which could translate to less fish. Yeah, right. Now, you know, to say those –
it's a lot more fun to eat rockfish than jellyfish.
Yeah. They taste a lot better. I've tried jellyfish, and it doesn't have a whole lot of flavor.
Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Jamie Pearson. This has been great.
Sure.
Good to meet you.
It's good to meet you, too. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for letting us be here. That was Dr. Jamie Pearson, who studies zooplankton at the University of Maryland's Horn Point Lab. Coming up now, on Delmarva correspondent Tom Horton joins us from his canoe in the waters near his home in Salisbury.
Hello. I'm Tom Horton for On Delmarva. You know, living on this peninsula keeps me on edge, makes me feel edgy. That's a good thing. It means I'm never far from Delmarva's long and glorious edges of land and water, Chesapeake on the west, Delaware Bay and Atlantic on the east. I once spent a week bicycling the whole of Delmarva, following its perimeters. Once I took a whole month to kayak around it. Either way, you're talking 450, 500 miles. But if you were to follow every curve and indentation of the Delmarva Coast, the tidal edges of its coastal bays, rivers, marshes, and islands, well, you'd be traveling for years. Straightened out, those land-water edges would stretch thousands of miles. That's more than a statistical curiosity, because there's something about life that loves an edge. Worldwide, coastal fringes like ours are a tiny fraction of the planet's waters, but they support a huge portion of everything in nature that depends on aquatic habitats. When ecologists and economists recently calculated the worth of Earth's natural resources, the amazing thing was not the value, tens of trillions of dollars annually, but that about half of all that came from the small but fabulously productive coastal margins, just like ours on Delmarva. You don't need a PhD to get a sense of that. Get yourself a 25-foot fine mesh seine net, the kind biologists use for sampling, and wade out during summer from most any shoreline. If you do it right, you'll come up with a wriggling mass of minnows, crabs, jellyfish, baby fish, grass shrimp, and other species, all from a patch of water no bigger than your living room. Now figure out how many times your living room would fit along thousands of miles of Delmarva coastline. You'll begin to get an appreciation for life on the edge. And it's more than minnows. The fruits and pleasures of the edge are virtually boundless. Sunsets that glow on 80-foot bayside sand dunes down on Virginia's eastern shore, and sunrises sloshing color on Assateague beaches sparkling in the surf. Sweeps of salt marsh that change color and texture with every shift and whim of the light and the wind and the seasons. Up the rivers, where salt water turns to sweet, stands of plumy, lemony gold wild rice cloak the banks in August. And cordgrass on autumn evenings roars with the sound of red-winged blackbirds roosting by the thousands. Nesting eagles and ospreys, back big time since we banned DDT, increasingly adorn our edges. To watch them soar and sky dance and dive on fish is to know why raptor and rapture spring from the same Latin root. No wonder we humans love the edges just as much as the rest of nature. Half of everyone on Earth is estimated to live on about 5% of the planet around land-water edges. More than half of all Americans are within an hour's drive of edges, and more moving in every day. There's growing evidence that if we really love the edges, we need to keep some distance. Smithsonian scientists have found that birds and fish and water quality along natural edges start declining at lower levels of human disturbance than anyone thought. Natural buffers wider than half a mile may be needed to protect some edges, and for the most part, that ain't happening. Pavement around here is increasing even faster than population, creating more stormwater runoff, our fastest growing source of pollution. And stone riprap and other bulkheading to protect homes from erosion has replaced hundreds of miles of natural shoreline around Delmarva in the last decade or two. We'll armor thousands of miles more in the next century, leaving less room for horseshoe crabs and terrapins and shorebirds to lay their eggs. We need to live on the edges with a lot more sensitivity, and to remember that for so many creatures, the edge is not just desirable or an amenity, it's vital.
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of On Delmarva. To hear this episode, download past programs, and see pictures from our travels on Delmarva, please visit us on the web at www.ondelmarva.org. And we'd love to hear your thoughts and ideas for upcoming shows. So please send them to comments@ondelmarva.org. We'll hope you join us again next week. Thanks. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com.